We often hear about migrants trying to make their way to Europe for a better life. And one of those ways is by sea. Thousands do it every year. And when we hear about these journeys, it's often because their hopes to reach Europe have ended in tragedy in some way. The number of people dying from boats leaving North Africa, then capsizing in the Mediterranean, has vastly increased over the past year. We get to hear the figures. It's 3,419 deaths in 2014. And sometimes we see pictures of those who survived. We might even hear from them briefly. But within hours, or perhaps at most a day or two, they are gone and the news moves on. But what happens to those who do actually make it to Europe? What life awaits them? And what led them to make the decision to come? Well, that's the journey we are going to take in the next hour. I'm Nuala McGovern, and this is Surviving the Most Lethal Route in the World. And to do that, we're going to focus on one boat, described by those who took it as not at all seaworthy and crammed with 300 adults and 100 children.
There's no space in the boat, and my mommy don't even know how to swim a little bit. So how are we gonna save her? We see the boats who come and help you to get you. They come and they take these people and they leave us. And then the last time they helped us, my mommy got on, and then my brother, and then me. And then they said for my daddy, there's no space. And then we start like fighting. I will come down in the water if my daddy don't come up.
He said in Libya he would take them to the beach all the time, and they would swim. And he goes, as soon as they reached the beach, they would literally just take off their clothes and jump into the water. They used to love the sea so much, and it turns out their death was in the sea.
His son
Muhammad would, you know, when the boat was going left and right, he said, "Dad, can I just have one last kiss?" And because he was helping other people, he just kissed him quickly. He said, No, can I have a kiss on the lip?" And that was the last kiss.
It left from North Africa for Europe on October 11, 2013, considered by the UN's refugee agency as the most dangerous sea crossing in the world. Now, you might know that for decades this route has been frequented by young sub-Saharan men, but they now share these dilapidated migrant boats with a new demographic, Syrian families fleeing the war in their country. And that's really where this story begins.
We left Syria after about 1 year and a half from the beginning of the war. Before, I don't want to leave Syria, really, because I have house and I have shop and everything was okay in Damascus. But after, the bombing was up the roof, up our roof.
The roof of your house?
Yes. And my family all scared, really. They scared. We decided to go to Lebanon. After, we decided to go to Egypt. I tried in Egypt to find also work, no work. I decided to go to Libya.
That area that he was living was actually the first area any Arab and Syrian would know. It was the first area in Damascus to be sieged from both sides. So if he went this way, the Free Syrian Army would shoot. If he went to Bashar al-Assad's way, they would shoot.
That's Ayad Al-Rosen and Rafat Hazima. Rafat speaking to me there through a translator. And these two fathers from Damascus came to make the same decision. They also became friends under very challenging circumstances. And they both boarded that same ill-fated boat from Libya. So you might decide that life is intolerable in Syria, but then you've still got to choose whether to risk your life and the lives of your family, and also your life savings. Here's Ayad and Rafat telling me why they felt this boat was their only option.
In Libya, I opened shop there and I began their new life. But also there's bombing and there's thieves in Libya and no safe life there.
And actually now Libya is in a bad state.
Now, yes, very bad now, Libya. Maybe we are lucky because we are left Libya. After that, we decided to go by the sea because this is the first choice, the only choice for us to go to another country and we find safe and I can find future for my sons.
He said, I wanted to leave Syria with dignity. He went to all the embassies, Libyan embassies, European embassies. He applied for visas, you know, refugee. They all refused. So no one accepted him, basically. He had all the money that he can to try to travel with dignity, but it just didn't work out. No one accepted.
Ayad told me about life in Libya before getting on that boat, and looking back, it's easy to see now that it didn't bode well. He told me he and his family lived in a cramped house for 10 days. They were held by people traffickers, and there were 125 people there with just one bathroom. The conditions were appalling, but he was still convinced about making the journey. Well, you're going to meet other members of these two families, the Alrosans and the Hazimas, and you're going to hear what happens after boarding that boat, leaving from the port of Zawara in Libya for Europe. I want to move to the 11th of October 2013, when this boat capsized in the southern Mediterranean. Malta's Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat, he came out and he described the Mediterranean waters as turning into a cemetery. Well, over a number of hours on that day, those that were rescued were brought either to the Italian island of Lampedusa or to the island of Malta. I took a plane to Malta's capital, Valletta, and I went to a migrant centre where those who had survived were taken. And within minutes, I met Malham, a 20-year-old Palestinian-Syrian man, and he is Ayad Alrosan's son. Well, he was standing outside a shipping container, and these containers were all over the camp as they were used to house migrants. I could see bunk beds inside, and the camp, well, I suppose I describe it as an expanse of grey concrete, and it was very, very hot that day. Malham was wearing a New York Yankees cap. He also had a white singlet on, and he has piercing blue eyes which strike you when you first meet him. And he was very agitated, as were many of the migrants who had just been brought ashore after spending hours in the freezing water. Some of the people they had travelled with and befriended had drowned in that sea beside them.
It's small, about 90 meters, but the people is about 400.
400 people?
Yes, 300 the big and 100 children. And the first came the police Libyan and tried to make us turn back to Libya. But the captain said no and we will keep going.
And what were you thinking at that point?
Oh, everyone was scared, and in the night, and the sea, and high sea, and the situation is very terrible. After that, 6 hours follow us, the police, Libyan, and try to make us to turn back. But captain trying again and again and again to keep going.
And did you want to turn back, or did you want
no,
to keep
no,
going?
No, he turned back once, but the guys with
on
us...
On the boat?
Yeah, tell him no.
Keep going.
Yes, keep going. After that, began to shoot us, shoot the boat.
Who did?
The police Libyan. Shoot the boat and shoot the three people. One here and one here and one here.
What were they trying to do by shooting?
Make us to come back.
To turn back?
Yeah. I make that like that and say there are children, and they no respect.
You've just lifted up this young man here. Hi, what's your name?
Mohammed.
Hello, Mohammed. So you lifted up Mohammed like up to the air to show that you had children with you?
Yes, we have children and women, but they kept going to shoot us, fire. After that, go, sit 6 hours in the sea and follow us. In the morning, boat is problem.
It's beginning to rock side to side, okay.
But the captain said, no problem, that's okay, we will keep going. Everyone is scared. After that, we call the Salib Ahmar. But they late.
They called the Coast Guard to say there's a problem.
They told us talk with the Italian Lampedusa, call the Malta.
So people were saying call Malta, Lampedusa. Lampedusa says call Malta.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But we want to go Lampedusa.
You didn't want to come to Malta.
No one here want to stay here. Everyone want to go Lampedusa.
Why did you want to go to Lampedusa?
We want to keep going to Sweden.
Sweden.
They given us very help. After that, the sea is high. Everyone is moved from side to side, trying to make the boat is
balance.
Yes. to stop the boat in one way. Mm. But we don't know.
Don't understand maybe what's going to happen.
Yes. After that, the boat is fall down and every people in sea.
Did you go into the water?
Yes, 2 hours in the sea. 2 hours in the sea. I saw my father and the captain trying to make him to in the sea and take the jacket saving.
Yeah, the life jacket.
Yeah, life jacket. To take you to my father.
The captain tried to take the life jacket father, off
yes,
your father.
My little brother tell me, your father. I saw him and the swimming to him and hit the captain. And take my father, then I saw my little brother and saw him. Then my mom is lost. Searching for my mom, searching, and then I meet my mom and bring my mom and to my father and my brother and go to help my friends, another people, very die. Children in the sea dies. I'm swimming and cry. Everyone try to make the people who has the life jacket to take them from another.
So somebody didn't have a life jacket,
they hold on to somebody who has a life jacket. Yes, okay. And drink to water. Everyone fighting to take life jacket. And then come the helicopter, then came the big boat and take us.
But you must be trying to see who is with you on the boat, right? Because you've got your family.
My family is good, but another, my friend, 22 person lost, I know.
There were quite a few children in the migrant camp who had survived the boat journey. The disaster, however, clearly left its mark on Hamad Al-Rozin, who is Ayad's son, just 10 years old at the time.
I was just swimming with my father. I just find him and I just hold his hand. Then when I find my brother, my daddy told him, go and find your mommy. My father, he came with me. My brother went to go and try to find my mommy, and he find her. She was very, very tired. And then we lost Molham.
Oh, no.
Yes. We stayed together. He said he's going to help the people, and then we lost him. Then the helicopter started sending a small box.
So like a lifeboat, they call them.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry.
That's okay. Okay, and how many people were in the boat, do you think?
Five.
Because it's small.
Small, tiny boat.
Very small. It's a box.
Yeah, so not much bigger maybe than your kitchen table.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we see the boats who come and help you to get you. They come and they take these people and they leave us. And we go more far.
You're floating away?
Yeah, because the water is so high. And then another boat come and try to help us. And then the last time they helped us, my mommy got on, and then my brother, and then me. And then they said, for my daddy, there is no space. And then we start, like, fighting. I will come down in the water if my daddy don't come up. So we got him in the boat.
You just pulled your daddy up with Malham and mommy?
Yeah. And then the men start climbing up.
Other people?
Yeah.
Onto this side of the boat?
Yeah, and then the helpers get up. Only the men, the small babies and the women and me. We went from other side. The small boat, it go in the ship. And then the ship get us up.
Oh, okay. So let me describe that for our listeners. I know what you're talking about. There's kind of a little opening at the back of a bigger boat.
Yeah.
And they bring this small lifeboat, really dingy thing, into the center.
Yeah.
And once you're safe in the center of the boat, then you get on the big boat.
Exactly. And then we saw them. And then when we arrived Malta after 10 hours, me and my mommy come down, and then they didn't get my father and my daddy with us. They was gonna get them to the spring. Like, the families go to the camps, and the men stay in the spring.
Oh, yeah, like the detention center. Yeah.
And then I told them, I don't speak English. I just told them father, brother. Then he said, oh, okay, and he got them with us. If I didn't tell them like this, my daddy and my brother will go to the...
So Malham might have saved your mother, but you saved Malham and Ayad, your daddy.
Yeah. Yes.
So the Al-Rozins, well, they were one family that I met as I was given access to the migrant centre for just a couple of hours on that Sunday morning. But this is a story about two families. When I was at the migrant centre, I was accompanied by Ramona Attard. She's a government spokesperson, and she was answering some of my questions when this happened.
Now we've seen these Syrians, of course, due to what's happening in Syria, everyone knows what's happening. So yes, we might get more Syrian immigrants. I hope that if we get them, there won't be any tragedies.
Where is that man from?
That's from Syria, so if you want to cut the interview for now.
He is down on his knees. He is just distraught with grief. Some of the other people are going to comfort him. And he's speaking on the phone, I guess, to somebody who perhaps has news of his relatives.
We are trying to provide mobile phones so they can speak to their relatives. Yesterday, literally, I have provided my mobile phone so they could call whoever you want. Of course, I don't think that's good news for me. And this is what we have been witnessing now for 2 days.
He's an older man, I would say, perhaps. He's a man that's perhaps in his 50s, and he's been supported by a lot of the younger men that have come. The young men that came really just a few days ago, as I've heard, that are Syrian and Palestinian, and they're trying to comfort him. They're giving him a little bit of water and trying to console him, and have come with another phone to keep him speaking with them, I guess, his relatives. So Ramona is back with us. She just went over to...
Sorry, they have confirmed, because they have confirmed that his son is dead.
Oh my goodness. The poor man has collapsed, and some of the younger men are now carrying him away. So sad. It turned out not one, but two young sons of Rafat Hazima were lost that day. It also turned out that Rafat was in his early 40s, but so overcome with grief that he had appeared much older to me. That was on Sunday. On Monday, I spoke again to Rafat, this time with Ayad beside him, translating.
He looked so distraught yesterday and so upset, and no. I'm so sorry that he got that news.
Yes.
But is it definite? Is it confirmed? There's so much confusion. No confirmed.
Some people told him that his two sons are alive, but also nobody confirmed.
What age are your sons?
He wants to see his children. He wants to know if they are alive or dead.
I know you're upset, Rafat.
United Nations, the reason of dying his children, if his children died.
I want my children,
he said. Alive or dead, please.
Of course.
Please.
After this race, may have my children wear the good life and safe. Okay? I lose all people here without document. Okay, so lose in the sea and money and document and passport. Okay.
I understand.
I lose my daughter to all dears and I wait any news about you.
وأنا أرجو من الإذاعة البي بي سي.
I want from BBC.
أن تساعدني بأقصى قوة في نشر دعوتي من أجل أطفالي.
Tell the world about my children.
So you hear the distress and how much he's already trying to get confirmation of what actually happened. And I want to take a moment here to talk about a tragedy like this in an era of social media. Because however much you rely on your phone day to day, you cannot imagine the clamour to get access to one after something like this. Rafat took my phone to show me photos of his young sons that were posted online, and he wanted to rewatch footage of the boat capsizing to see if he could see his sons and perhaps figure out what had happened to them. And of course, he wanted to make phone calls to try and get answers from whomever may pick up that phone. But those answers didn't come when I was with him. And social media plays another part in this story because we left abruptly, as news teams often do. We didn't get to say goodbye properly. None of the people we met had a phone or an address or any way to keep in touch. But I did think of them often during the year. And as the months rolled around and the anniversary of that shipwreck became closer, we began to make a concerted effort to try and track them down. And this took a while.
I'd been thinking about the Alrosans for a while, but I couldn't find them anywhere. They weren't on Facebook, and Rosemary, a journalist who we'd been working with in Malta, she couldn't find any trace of them either. She even asked the Maltese authorities for us, but they didn't know where they were. So I really thought I'd hit a bit of a dead end, but then I got a direct message from her on Twitter saying that a Syrian family told her they were in Germany. And after that, we spotted an online feature in the Times of Malta about them. It was written before they left, but it mentioned the fact they were planning to start a new life in Germany. So I contacted the editor and got a German phone number. Eventually I did find Malham on Facebook, but he's changed his profile name to William Alrosen. He thinks that's easier for Germans.
I also had footage taken from the hospital in Valletta off Rafat, which we sent to Malham Alrosen. Now, Malham knew exactly who we were talking about and where he was once he saw that footage. So where were they? And what happened to them? Well, the profile photo of Rafat on Facebook, that was unexpected, to me anyway. It was Rafat smiling, and that was something that I had never seen. And he was surrounded by snowy pine trees. But, as we know, Facebook often, maybe even usually, doesn't tell the real story.
He lost his two sons, and in Malta, I thought that he's sick. There's something in his mind, because it was a shock for him, you know. And I think till now he don't believe that his sons, they are dead. But that's not what I think, you know.
So we need to get into where they are now, not only emotionally, but also physically. We found out the Alrosans, they were in a place for refugees in Kirchsarten, a tiny town in the southwest of Germany, about an hour from the Swiss border. So what happened to the Alrosan family and to a family member that they left behind in Libya?
We don't have money enough for him. So Yamin work a little bit and then he go.
And Rafat Hazima, well, he was in a suburb called Bartsbüttel outside of Hamburg in the north of the country. Stay with us as we discover how life unfolded for these two families, the Alrosans and the Hazimas, after they took what's been called the most lethal route in the world.
Weekends on the BBC World Service.
I'm Rodrigo Pinto, and this month on Global Beats, we are in one of the most musically rich cities in Europe, Portugal's capital, Lisbon.
Já fiz uma viagem longe, longe
with the traditional and dramatic fado.
Da margem esquerda da vida, parte uma ponte.
And the more contemporary African-inspired sound of kuduro. There are musical influences from around Portugal and the world. Meet some of the country's most innovative and diverse artists. Global Beats from Lisbon. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
Hello, I'm Nuala McGovern, and this is Surviving the Most Lethal Route in the World on the BBC World Service. One boat, two Syrian families, and a desperate desire to reach Europe. I first met the Alrosan and Hazima families in Malta in a migrant centre following a tragedy where their boat capsized and dozens drowned. Coming up, their compelling stories of how their lives evolved when I met them again 1 year later.
BBC News with Marianne Marshall. Thousands of people have attended the funeral in New York of Rafael Ramos, one of the two policemen shot dead in their patrol car a week ago. Vice President Joe Biden told mourners that the deaths had touched the soul of an entire nation. When New York's mayor, Bill de Blasio, rose to speak, many officers watching on screens outside turned their backs on him. They accuse him of fostering anti-police sentiment by supporting protests against them. Chinese state media say North Korea has suffered a further internet failure amid an escalating war of words with the United States over a cyber attack on Sony Pictures. The Xinhua news agency said the country's internet and 3G mobile networks were paralyzed for at least 2 hours. Officials in Somalia say a senior member of the Islamist group Al-Shabaab is in their custody after being found in a town near the Kenyan border. The official said that after receiving a tip-off, government troops discovered Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersi hiding in a house. The United States had offered a $3 million bounty for information leading to his location. The former Liberian footballer George Weah has won a landslide victory in Senate elections held last week despite the Ebola outbreak. Mr. Weah won 78% of the vote for the important Monserrado County seat, which includes the capital, Monrovia. He beat Robert Sirleaf, the son of the Liberian president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The Turkish man, who shot and almost killed Pope John Paul II in 1981, has laid flowers on his tomb in the Vatican. The gesture, by Mehmet Ali Aga, came 31 years to the day that the Pope visited him in prison and forgave him. Sweden's centre-left government has announced a deal with the mainstream opposition in order to avert holding a snap election and to counter the rising influence of the far right. The deal sidelines the anti-immigration Sweden Democrats. BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Nuala McGovern. This is a story about surviving the most lethal route in the world. In the first half of this programme, we met the Al-Rosans and the Hazima families, Syrians I had encountered in Malta in a migrant centre. They had become friends under very difficult circumstances. They had fled Syria. They had made it to Libya and they were housed together in terrible conditions by traffickers. And that was until they took a boat, again together, trying to make it to Europe. But the boat they were on, it capsized. One family, the Al-Rosans, they survived, but the Hazimas lost their two young sons. 1 year later, we had tracked them down and wanted to hear how the past 12 months had been.
They catch us. Yes, we are arrested. They make a court next day for us and they give us a sentence of 7 months. We are shocked. Everyone go outside. Everyone, every single one. We are the first family who put us in the prison.
He said when he was in Syria, his wife was employed, he was employed, the money was amazing. He said anything that my children asked for, they never heard no from them. And he was like, you know, there's witnesses. Everything that he would, you know, get for his children, anything, it didn't matter what the price was. He said Friday and Saturday were his days, basically, where he would take his sons to the beach, go fishing, live life how it's supposed to be lived. He says now it's a completely different story. His son's asking for a laptop. He goes, I have nothing. He has nothing in his bank. It's just, it's a complete transformation from the way that he was.
I found it hard to imagine the Al-Rosans in the Black Forest in southwest Germany and Rafat in the north of the country outside of Hamburg. Although all are in Europe, it seemed a world away from those hot, cramped refugee conditions in Malta. But in reality, I had no idea of their living arrangements now. We made appointments to meet up, all through social media and a few texts, but the life of a migrant is so transient that people can move on within days. And I can't tell you how often the people I've met don't have enough money for phone credit, so communication can be erratic. I did wonder whether our plans to meet up would actually work. I had thought about Rafat many times. The story of losing his sons had touched many of our listeners who had also asked about him during the year. So, on a cold December morning, I went to meet him again, this time in an industrial suburb about 40 minutes outside Hamburg in northern Germany. So I'm just turning into a house here, like a large A-frame, but, you know, bricks and mortar. White house, number 20, a little car outside. I don't know how many people live in here. Child scooter is outside and a skateboard, and it's all very well maintained. There's a little tin with
you know, smoked cigarettes, just the butts of cigarettes, and the door is propped open with a broomstick. I'm just going up the stairs, brown tiles, and I can hear Rafat is just around the corner, so I'm just going to take my time and say hello. And I step into the pink carpet. Hello, 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 hello. It's so good to see you.
Good.
Okay?
Good.
Yeah. Hello. We didn't meet last time. Hello. My name is Nuala. Thank you for having us. It's good to see you here in Germany. I hear you've had a lot of traveling this year.
He says, yeah, a lot, and he still expects to travel even more because he didn't take the asylum seeker. He applied, but they still never responded to his his application, basically.
Would you like to stay in Germany?
He wants to stay here. However, if he doesn't stay here, I think they're going to send him back to Malta. And he was like, Malta is a nice city. The people are beautiful and everything. But this is where the tragedy happened. So he goes, every time he goes there, it's a shock. He says sometimes he would wife when he was in Malta, he'd find his wife at the beach looking for her children and stuff like that. So he doesn't want to go back. He knows that if he does not get the asylum seeker here, he's lost. He has no way out.
So we saw you there. We were still in that Halfour center, you know, the migrant center. And that's where we spoke to you for a couple of days. What happened afterwards? You got the phone calls, you got these conflicting reports about whether your sons might be alive. So what did you do next after I left you? What happened?
What happened is after you left, people of Malta helped him. They gave him clothes, money, etc. And they said to him, go to Italy and look for your sons. They stayed there for 2 months trying to see if they could find his sons, whether dead or alive. However, they put pictures of the alive people. His sons weren't there. The dead, his sons weren't there. So he never knew whether they're alive or not. Afterwards, he stayed in a camp where people, the refugees stayed. 15 days he stayed in Italy. Afterwards, they gave him money and they said to them, go to Sweden, try to get asylum seeker. Once you get the asylum seeker, come back to Italy and continue looking for your son.
And in Sweden, why was his asylum rejected? Was he given a reason?
Because of his fingerprint in Malta.
They think that he has to stay in Malta. Just looking at an older video of Rafat with his three sons and his wife in Libya before they boarded the boat. There was an interview done with them. They had left Syria and made their way to Libya and were then trying to make the journey over to Europe. It's very sad to see your little boys there, you know, as they speak and they're so full of hope.
He said when he was speaking, one of his sons there, they said, we really want to go to Europe because it's the country of respect and mercy and love and future. And basically he said, now two sons are gone and the third one's on the way because he just can't live. He can't live with moving and having to travel.
Can I come back, Rafat, to your sons again? Because you talked about wanting to settle and then look for your sons. Perhaps I could take this opportunity just if you wanted to tell our listeners what Ahmed and Hamad were like as kids.
He lived 12 years and 9 years, the best memories of his life. This is where the hardest part is. When you lose a child when they're young, it doesn't hurt as much as when you lose them when they're older.
بليبيا نروح على البحر كل جمعة أخذنا على البحر ابني أحمد وابني محمد دغري أول ما بوصل على البحر بتلاقيهم بيشلحوا وعيهم بينزلوا بابا شفت بنعرف نسبح بيحبوا البحر بشكل وراحوا ماتوا بالبحر.
He said in Libya he would take them to the beach all the time and they would swim, and he goes, as soon as they reached the beach they would literally just take off their clothes and jump into the water. They used to love the sea so much, and it turns out their death was in the sea.
ولادي صرخوا
نحن ما صرنا نركض عشان نعمل توازن بالقارب. اجوا اولادي صرخوا، اخر ركضه كانت لالي، اجى ابني الصغير قال لي بابا بابا محمد اعطيني بوسه. قلت له خذ بابا بوسه، قال لي لا بدي بوسه من هون. هاي اخر بوسه لالي.
He said the day that he was they were in the boat, his son would
his son مين اللي حكى لك عطيني بوسة محمد. His son Muhammad would you know when the boat was going left and right, he said dad can I just have one last kiss. And because he was helping other people, he just kissed him quickly. He said no, can I have a kiss on the lip. And that was the last kiss. Sometimes someone knows they're about to go. He just knew. He knew that he was going to go.
What strikes me when I listen to Rafat now is how little has changed. The physical location is jarringly different, of course, but his state of mind and his grief have not. He has the same questions. He cries just as easily, within moments really, when talking about his sons, Mohammed and Ahmed. And this time I also got to speak to Rafat's wife, Fariel, who had in Malta, understandably, closed herself away from the world. She sat upright in a straight-back chair, dressed in a black abaya, her hands folded in her lap. And though grief-stricken, she opened her home to us, making us tea. She had baked a coconut cake and was very welcoming to us. It did make me wonder what she was like before this tragedy occurred. I asked her through a translator why Fariel thought her sons might still be alive.
She still has hope. This whole year, she has hope. She goes every interview that we do. I hope something comes out of it. She says I still run after the news to try to find her children, but nothing. She says I pray. She sits at the window and she prays day and night.
Is it that she hasn't been able to see proof that her sons may have died, that keeps that hope alive?
Mother's instinct. She says, I feel that they're alive. She says, sometimes I can hear them saying, Mom, I'm hungry. Or she says, sometimes I dream of me basically sitting with them and doing their homework.
Such a shock then it must be when she wakes up, dreaming and then...
She says, it's the living nightmare. When she wakes up, it's the nightmare.
He says it's really hard to sit on the table, and when it was five plates, it's three now. There's no sounds anymore. He goes, I'm used to them fighting. I'm used to them hitting each other. He goes, now my son's in the room, just stares at the wall the whole time, has nothing to do. It's not life for them anymore.
Because that's what I was going to ask next, Faria. What about Anas? Because I know he's still a child, really. He's just 16 and has had such a traumatic year as well. He's lost his two younger brothers. I suppose what future for him? Does she think about that?
She can't do anything with Anas. She just can pray because now her hands are tied with the situation that they're living in Germany. And she says, I mean, I pray, and with every prayer, my hope becomes bigger and bigger, but she's just basically tired. She says everything hurts in her body, everything.
The Hazimas and the Alrosans had fled Syria at the start of the war, and now years later, they're both awaiting asylum in Germany. The war and that tragic boat journey meant that their lives intersected briefly in both Libya and Malta.
Yeah.
You may think that Rafat's story is exceptionally sad, but it's not, or so Malham Al-Rosen told me. He said his family was one of only three families on board that all members survived. And perhaps that is the exceptional story. So what about the Al-Rosen family a year later? Just waiting at the Bahnhof, at the train station here in Kirchsarten, where I says I'd meet Malham Al-Rosen, the young man who I met last year in such traumatic circumstances. And I see him walking up. He has his hoodie on. It's quite wrapped up compared to the last time. Malham, how are you? Good to see you.
Hi, how are you?
Really good nice morning. To see you again. Nice how are you?
I'm good, and you?
Yeah, really good. Hi, and you remember Deirdre?
It was really nice to see you again.
Good to see
you. Very well.
Yeah.
Different situation.
Yeah.
Different weather.
Different weather, that's
you
for sure.
You still have the hat, though, like the last time.
It's good to see you. Okay, so it's not far from the train station, is it?
No, that's building, you see it?
Yeah?
Yes.
The yellow building?
Yeah, there. Yeah.
Okay, so it's like a kind of a large house.
We try to start from the beginning, from the zero.
Do you hope Germany will be your home?
Yeah. It's a good city. We are relaxed here. We feel good here. It's good people.
It's a big change.
Yes, big change. But I think it's good change, not bad change.
And what's life like here?
Everything. In the start, it's difficult, you know, but slowly, when we learn the language, when we know the city around, when we have a friend, then it will be easier.
But your original home is Damascus, is Syria. Do you still think about that?
No, because everything is damaged now. Now for one and a half year there, they are without electric, without water, without food. Without nothing.
And do you miss Syria?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So you've only been here a couple of months. So I suppose we're sitting here in this room. There's some bunk beds to the left of me. The bed covers are all tucked in. There's a couple of cuddly toys in the corner there. And the table in the middle with a bright orange tablecloth and orange curtains. It's very inviting. It's very warm, very welcoming. And one fridge I see behind me and a couple of closets and your suitcases as well.
One, two.
Because when I met you in Malta, you didn't have anything.
Yes, I never have anything because I was in the sea for 4 hours. So what I will bring with me from the sea, a fish? I still have nothing.
Well, the amazing thing that you did bring from the sea is your family. That was amazing that you all stayed together.
Yes, because when they save us, we are all four together. So we hug other and we cry because we are happy, not because we are sad, to be all together, you know?
As we chatted, I realized we were just really scratching the surface of what had happened to them, and they were still processing that harrowing journey.
Like others, we was 147. Everyone tried by any way to go outside Malta.
And I might just say the 147 are the people that were rescued off your boat. Yeah.
Yes. So we tried to make, like others, to make a false passport.
Can I just ask, where would you get the false passport? Was it easy to get?
No, it's from from Greece.
Yeah. Do people send it to you?
Yes. They send it and we try to go by the boat. For me, it's okay. My mother, okay. My father, okay. Then they see my brother. Yes, his photo in every newspaper. So I think...
And let me just explain, Hamad... Yes. Who became, I suppose, a poster boy in a way of the migration in Malta, and his picture became very well known. So this was the problem right here, this beautiful problem.
Yes, because of him. Yes, we think so. I'm not sure, but we think so. They catch us.
So you're stopped. They look at Hamad. What happens? Who stops you?
Who book the chair on the plane, you know, before
you... So you were going on the airplane.
Yes.
Had you gone to the airport?
Yes, we are in the airport.
Had you checked in?
Yes, we make a check-in and we go...
Up the escalator through security?
Yes.
Did you get to just about to board the plane?
It's just one move to go to the plane.
And then what happened?
Yes, they tell us to stay for a minute and they call the police and...
I was speak with my chatting with my brother. I tell him, they catch us. I speak with you later. Yes, we are arrested. I speak with you later. And they start. No.
Did they arrest mom as well?
No. My mother and my brother. No, just me. Yeah.
And then what happened?
They make a court next day for us, and they give us a sentence of 7 months. It will be 4 months and 20 days.
And exactly, what did you think? 21
days. We are shocked. Everyone go outside. Everyone, every single one. We are the first family put us in the prison. You know? If we know that it will be very dangerous like this, we will never do it. We will, of course, stay in Malta.
And what was the prison like?
Listen, the prison, it's like hotel from inside, but that's not our problem. The problem, it's my mom and my brother outside. We was very worrying about them because he wasn't speak English. My mother didn't speak English and they didn't know anyone. But we help people. So God help my mother and my brother. Some people help my mother and my brother to find a flat, and they stay there.
And were you with your dad, Ayad, when you were in there?
Yes, he was with me. Together. Same room.
And, you know, you said something interesting there. You said it was like a hotel inside.
Yes, everything good. It's clean, good food. The prison, not our problem, I tell you. Just, yes, my mother.
That you were separate.
It's difficult, yes, it's difficult for us. We are just thinking, it's more difficult than the prison, you know? If we still worrying, always worrying.
We had more to talk about, so we returned for breakfast the next morning. And there was a somewhat celebratory atmosphere. And that agitation from a year previously, well, that had evaporated. It had turned into an easy laugh, even about difficult topics, like the brother the family had to leave behind in Libya.
Yemen.
So when I spoke to you a year ago and this journey that I keep coming back to that you are going to forget, and I'm going to let it go after this because I understand wanting to put something traumatic behind you. You went to Libya, which was a bad situation, being in a crowded house, being taken by people smugglers. And then at the last moment, they put the price up to bring people across and your brother couldn't come.
Yes. We don't have money enough for him. So Yamin work a little bit and then he go to Germany before us here.
So how did he get to Germany?
By sea, by the boat.
Another dangerous boat?
Yes.
After your experience?
Yes.
And when you heard then, when did you hear that he had made it to Germany?
Maybe after 5 months.
Okay, so let's rewind for a second. You were in Malta.
Yeah.
And when you were all in Malta, your brother Yarmin, he decided to take a boat from Libya?
Yeah.
And what way did he go?
Italy, then I think Switzerland, Germany, and he came
and up.
And he came here.
When was the first time that you saw him? Here. What was it like?
Yeah, he hugged me in the middle of the street and he didn't want to let me go. In the middle of the street, you know, the cars come and he didn't let me want to go. I tell him, just come a little bit here, let the cars go. Yeah, he was hugged me very, very strong. This is the first time my big brother hugged me like this. Yeah, it was very great.
How long was it since you had seen him the previous time?
More than 1 year, I think. More than 1 year.
Watching his son speak was their dad, Ayad Al-Rosen.
Ayad, you have a lovely family. How do you feel about the future?
I am not afraid now from the future because I am here in Germany. I think they will give us house here in Germany. They will give us some money to begin our life. And my children all will return to school. My big son will go to the university. I am not afraid now, really.
You talked about that you were settled in Syria, that you had a life and you had future plans to perhaps help your sons get started with their house in a way that I know lots of parents who are listening will totally understand. What is it like then to have to depend on Sabina, who's behind me here, and also Karen and Margaret that we have met, and to have to take from them.
In Syria, I was also helping Iraqi people and Lebanese people. I have shop there, and the people, they was bringing rice and money and everything to my shop. Then I distribute to the Lebanese people and Iraqi people.
Isn't that interesting, though, that you were the person you gave before so many times?
This is the life now. I give and I take.
We're just clearing away some of the breakfast things. Am I tell our listener a little bit what we were eating there?
We ate Syrian food and Palestinian food as well. Ful and za'atar and labana and zaitoun and eggs.
Yes, the eggs were delicious as well. Lots of spices. Lots of people will want to know from you because now your English is so good.
Yeah.
You're 11 years old. What's it like here for a boy who's 11?
You know, I'm still not normal in here, but I'm normal in Malta very much. And I like Malta. And I feel it like it's my country.
What was good about Malta?
Everything. My house, my bicycle, my school, everything.
Tell me how you feel here. Do you feel safe, happy?
Yeah, because next week I'm gonna go to a house in Mulheim. And it's a nice place. And they give me a tree house with it.
There's a tree house?
For me, yes.
In the garden?
Yeah.
So do you know what the new house looks like?
Yeah, I went and I see it. There's three rooms, one room for me, it's the smaller room. It's like this room. And one more big a little bit for my brother. And one room for the biggest room in the house for my mother and my father. And there's two salons and one kitchen and one bathroom.
So you have a birthday coming up.
Yeah.
In less than a month, you're going to be 12. What do you hope will happen in the next year when you are 12?
I want to get in my birthday camera.
You want to get a camera?
Yeah.
And what would you take photographs of?
Germany. The mountains and those things.
The mountains are beautiful. Your family really likes them to go walking there, huh?
Yeah. It's so nice. I want to get a camera, really, in my birthday. I always tell my parents that I want a camera, I want a camera, I want a camera.
So what does looking at the stories of these two families answer? What I'm sure of is that people will continue to make that crossing despite the risks. I also know that life in Europe will be unpredictable and transient and tough for those who make it. And what I don't know, well, the list is long. Will either family gain asylum? Remains to be seen. How will 11-year-old Hamad grow up? Will Mulheim get to go back to school? And at 51 in a new country and a new language, will Ayad Al-Rosen work again? Perhaps the biggest question is whether Ferial and Rafat Hazima will find closure and even a small sense of peace in this new world. And whether the price they paid to survive the most lethal route in the world was worth it. The BBC.